at my peers of that time who were building great brands and great products and authentic and genuine and hardworking, who were just destroyed in that system. You take all the risk, you do all the hours. If it's a failure, we flick you out. And if it's a success, we just own brand it and then flick you out.
Welcome to episode 100 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. It feels damn good to say episode 100. Thank you so much for listening. Even if you listened for the first time this week or you're here since episode one, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been a privilege to do 100 episodes. I hope we do 100, 200, 300 more. I absolutely love doing this podcast and I love seeing the impact it has with people. So drop me a message. Let me know if you're enjoying the pod, what you're enjoying and what you'd like to see more of. It's community after all. This podcast is about you as it is me. So get in touch, let me know. We're marking episode 100 with a very special guest. Mr. Jack Crotty has come up with an idea, which I think is so timely for the times we live in now. At the start of lockdown, I was like, oh, I'd just love to see 5K around me and see what kind of local suppliers are there. And Jack has had this idea years ago and is now exploding due to COVID and due to it being such a good idea. If you go on neighborfood.ie, you can search where your local market is. And essentially, they're bringing farmers markets and local markets online, making them digital. It's a super idea. Jack explains it far better than I can. So let's kick off with episode 100. Jack, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be here.
We had a roving start to the interview. If you want to fill us in on where you were or where you are, I suppose it's quite interesting.
I live in Northern Italy. So I'm in a place called Alba. So I was taking advantage of the fact that midweek you can go and have lunch in places, which I think is a pretty good idea. Actually seems to be working over here so far anyway.
Yeah, you told me a little bit about that. Just explain that really quickly to people because I think people would be kind of interested to hear how it's going over there. So you were saying Monday to Friday.
We're during the COVID pandemic right now. And across the world, people are either in red zones, the orange zones, whatever. Whereas here, what they seem to be doing now is an orange zone midweek until 6 p.m. So restaurants and cafes can open and you can be inside socially distant until 6 o'clock when everything has to shut down. And then at the weekends, it's full lockdown.
Okay. That kind of makes a lot of sense. I like that idea.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a trial and I don't know if other places in the world are doing it, but I have to say being around, it does make sense because it's just not rushing people in different ways. Like naturally, restaurants are very busy at certain times and this is forcing people to use them in extended periods during the week. And it seems to be working and it's keeping people employed 5 days a week.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. I think that's what's really hurting people here. Restaurants, bars, cafes, they just have no certainty.
Yeah, but there's a little bit of a foolish opinion that you just give people a PUP, a pandemic unemployment payment, and that they can just sit at home and wait it out. Mm. But that's not working. People are being driven mad and they're doing stupid, crazy types of socializing or traveling or whatever. Whereas this seems to be a way that this can keep people with a purpose, doing something in a, you know, safe or at least proportionately safe kind of environment. And it seems to be keeping the cases down, but I guess we'll see.
Well, I think fundamentally you touched on it there. People want to be productive. People want to be working. It's you know, they don't want this money. They want something to do, especially if someone's been working hard for 10, 15, 20 years. Wouldn't know what to do with themselves from Monday to Friday for
you go mad,
day, you know.
Yeah.
And you think, yeah, how's it been over there? Just we'll touch on it briefly. We won't go too deep in it. It's been discussed to death. But how has it been for you living in Italy during this time?
Well, there's no doubt that in the beginning it was a little bit terrifying. My situation is a little bit different to others as well, in that my wife, my partner, wife to be, wife that would be, were it not for COVID. So.
Okay, gotta get that term correct, Jack. You'll get killed if she listens back to this.
So she was 7 months pregnant when they actually announced the lockdown.
Oh wow!
So we had a baby in the thick of it. At the time when we actually went to the hospital to have Rose, there were reports that if your baby contracts COVID, then mom and baby will be in ICU separated for 3 weeks. Was kind of like the general, that's what happens to babies, kind of a feeling. So, and the hospital, the only hospital that we could use because we live quite remotely, was actually a COVID emergency hospital. So I even remember going in there with Serena in labor and being asked to step up against the wall with face to the wall so that they could bring someone with COVID on a stretcher true behind us.
Oh gosh.
Not something I shared with my parents and friends and family at home.
No, you were seeing horrific images back then.
Yeah. I do remember thinking nothing in the moment because it was just so it's crazy. It's a crazy experience having a baby, but it's so methodical and so, you know, there's really just one clear linear objective. And then afterwards, kind of reflecting back on everything and kind of feeling the weight of like, Jesus, this is really insane. But luckily, everything went great. And then we went into a natural lockdown because when you have a baby, you're locked at home anyway. So we kind of felt like the world joined us for our newborn baby moment, which was nice. And also, one of the things that has been positive about COVID is how much more people are connecting with each other. And for me, living abroad, I feel I'm closer connected to my family and friends than I've been since the years I was living in Ireland, you know?
That's interesting.
Which is kind of nice.
What's been sparking that is?
Well, if you want to meet your neighbor, you have to go on a Zoom call or you have to give them a ring. So suddenly me living, you know, so many thousand kilometers away doesn't really matter anymore.
That's a fair
So
point.
I think everyone, like WhatsApp groups have gotten more activity and different organized online meetups have become a little bit more popular. So yeah, we this family here feel much more connected with Ireland than we have been before.
That's super really interesting. Nice. That's one positive effect. How long have you been in Italy?
Well, I've been here for 3.5, touching on 4 years now, but actually being a resident here a year and a half.
Okay. So you're somewhat unusual in the fact that you live in another country and run a business in a separate country.
Yeah.
So how did all that come about?
Semi built that way as well, to be honest.
Okay.
Because I built Neighbor Food while I was over here. I was half and half with my family here and working in Ireland because I have a food business in Ireland called The Rocket Man. So I was going back and forth trying to maintain my business at home, trying to maintain consultancy jobs that were actually sustaining me back and forth, and then kind of came across a model that kind of inspired me to create Neighbor Food. It's not like Neighbor Food exactly, but it has elements of it. And then thought, geez, this is great. It's an amazing thing. I got really excited about it as an idea, but also got really excited about the idea that I might not have to constantly be in a car or in a plane trying to work, and that I could actually do that remotely from here.
Tell me briefly what Neighbor Food is.
Well, it's a marketplace for an online marketplace for food and beverage producers in Ireland to sell directly to the public. So it's a place where a small business can upload their list of products and then sell them to the public through collection points that we create in different communities. So we'll establish a collection point in a town, let's say Tullamore. We'll identify a host in Tullamore. They'll build the collection point and manage the physical, you know, handing over of the products. And then we look after the online shops. The producers join. We pool them together in these online shops, and customers can order from everybody in their local area.
I gotta say, I love this idea. I, at the start of lockdown, was looking for something like this because back in March and April, you were like, oh my God, I don't even know what's in. Oh, we had just moved to a new house. I didn't even know it was within 5 kilometers. I was like, I couldn't tell you what's 5 kilometers that way or what's a totally new area, totally new everything. And I was looking, going, is there anything like local? And there was nothing like this. There was a few like random markets that had been posted on a Facebook group back in 2005. And I'm like, I don't even know if they're still working. So when Isabel sent this to me a few weeks ago, I was like, oh my God, this idea is genius. This sounds like something you dreamed up at the start of COVID, but I know it isn't.
It feels very much like we built it for COVID, but we're 2.5 years operating and have actually locations in Ireland that are going, you know, a couple of years now. We adapted a few things. We changed a little bit. We made it completely contact-free from the perspective of actually the behind the scenes as well as the delivery to the customers. Mm. We modified small pieces, like instead of giving you a 2-hour window to collect, which we give to the other 100 people who are coming to the collection, we now give slots, half-hour slots. So we divide down the number of people that could arrive there at any time. So we're doing crowd management and things. But other than that, mostly our process is contact-free.
Brilliant. Talk to me like just through the whole process. So I'm in Wicklow. I've actually searched. Actually, ironically enough, I got the email this morning from the local Neighbor Food that they're going live in a few weeks. So I was like, oh, perfect timing. So talk to me through, let's say I'm going to log on today. What am I going to see and what am I going to do?
Well, if you're going in cold, you're probably going to go into neighborfood.ie/markets. Or if you're living in the UK, neighborfood.co.uk/markets. And it'll bring you to a map and you see where you are and you can see who's close to you. And hopefully there'll be someone close enough. And then by joining that market, as we call it, although it is a digital market, you become a member of that list and you'll receive communications from the host. So you'll get the email to say, shop's now open for this week. And each week you can place a shop there and then you'll collect it at a collection point weekly. So there's a collection every week where all the producers drop off beforehand and then you, the customer, go and collect everything after.
So it's basically like doing your standard online shop, except you go and you collect it, but it's come from different providers, right? There's different people on the platform.
Exactly, yeah. So the suppliers, I mean, our warehouses, so to speak, are the individual producers and they receive more of a margin for dropping off directly to the customer. So the idea is that it's a much more margin-friendly approach for a small producer than considering trying to get into a supermarket or something like that, who need to take so much more to be able to maintain the service that they provide. So we're eliminating all of the fuss, basically, and allowing the small producers to sell direct.
It's such a perfect model for where the world is moving now. I mean, everyone is now looking inward and looking, going, okay, where's my nearest farm? Where's my nearest vegetable supplier? Where's my nearest eggs? Where's my nearest... It's incredible. How did you come up with that idea, Jack?
Well, I'm originally a farmer's market trader. I don't produce. I'm a city born person. I don't have a farm, but I would have had a business where we used a lot of local suppliers and then had a kitchen where we made food. So we had a salad bar, we had, you know, sandwiches, soups, stews, this kind of thing. And we have a premises in Cork City on Princes Street. And then we would have had a presence at a couple of farmers markets and different events. So I was in that community. I was going to the farmers market every day and I knew the people who were buying from their local producers, let's say. Mm. So I was one of those producers living on that microeconomy that exists in Ireland. And I always believed that there was more customers for those sellers, but that the farmers market model didn't suit everybody. And it's obvious why it doesn't. They generally happen in the middle of the day. A lot of people have to work. They usually happen on a Saturday morning when a lot of people have personal commitments. And it's a slow process. You got to go from one stall to the next stall to the next stall. It's inconsistent when you go there. Maybe the producer isn't there that week and you didn't know. Or maybe they've run out of something and you didn't get there early enough. So the idea for Neighborfood was just that direct link to be able to get consistency and to speed up the process. To say, you're a person who doesn't have the luxury of 2 hours to do your shopping. Mm-hmm. Here's something where you can order whenever you want during the week. And then when you arrive to the collection point, we get you through in minutes. You just go, everything is there for you. You get your box and you leave. And that was the kind of spirit of where the want and need for it came from.
So this isn't your first venture. What was your, you touched on it there, Rocket Man. What was your first venture?
It was a kitchen making food. I mean, I did the Ballymaloe cookery course in 2012. I had finished college and started working as a chef and really liked it and felt like this is what I want to do. I want to work in kitchens. So I went to Ballymaloe, the closest cookery school to Cork, but it was also, you know, very prestigious and considered to be an amazing opportunity. So I bit the bullet, saved every penny I could, got a good bit of support from my parents and went down there. And I think it was 2 weeks before the course even ended. I was so inspired down there by food, but by business, by the want to just get going that I started Rocket Man then. So I think I was 21 when I actually started Rocket Man. So it was cooking in my home kitchen, in my family home, and making food and bringing it to the farmer's market and selling it. And then that grew into two stalls, up to six stalls, up to two vans, up to several friends helping me out. And then a premises in the city, and at one point, two premises in the city with 17 staff. Like, I mean, it grew. Like,
that scaled fast. Over what kind of time frame are we talking about, Jack?
Well, the first 2 years I was by myself because I didn't take any. I didn't take a loan. I didn't build up anything. I did build up everything. So I literally would just, you know, make 200 euros, come home, buy 100 euros worth of food, go back, make 400 euros, put 300 of it back, buy another 100 euros, and then it just kept going like that. And as soon as you soon as you've been off for a van, you buy a van and then you go back in again. And I was also working as a chef in a restaurant to kind of supplement the neighborhood earnings for 2 years.
Wow. Okay.
So in those 2 years, I managed to get to a point where we could afford a fit out of a premises and a lease for about 60 or 70,000. And then got a little bit of help from some family to push it over the line and some close friends. And then launched that. So I think in the space from the end of year two, when I actually bit the bullet and became a real boy, it was probably 3 years. We had grown it to about 17 staff. So that was like the peak that it was at. You know,
that's a lot. I got to ask you the name. Where does that come from?
Well, it was like the salad leaves. Rocket leaves.
So it was simple enough.
It was a hero character with rocket leaves for a cape.
And what was your what was your food style? What were you doing?
It was. I suppose I can say it now because when I used to talk about Rocket Man to people, I was always careful to use these words. But it was a vegetarian focus. It was a plant based focused business, but not exclusively. Like, we weren't a vegetarian place. We weren't a vegan place, but we did get labeled that because we were about 80 or 90% vegan and vegetarian.
Okay. What was the goal? Was the goal to have a chain of them? Was the goal to have a chain of vans, a chain of markets? What was the goal at the end of the day?
I mean, the goal changed every day. I was very young and certainly very naive. I mean, I wasn't young to the point that some people get very mature in their teens. I didn't. I had a lot of maturity. I loved responsibility. I was very good at following through on things, but I still had no idea what I really genuinely enjoyed doing or what I wanted from it. I mean, maybe I didn't want, and it's the same with neighborhood now. I don't want something to be in a certain place, or I don't deal in those type of long-term goals because I much prefer to be responsive and take opportunities when you see them. But with Rocket Man, I definitely went through phases of like, okay, let's try and create a brand that we can create something externally and then sell it into supermarkets or something like this. So I explored all of those options when they came to me. And every time there was just always these big, big pitfalls, you know, which were the power of multinationals and the power of centralized distribution and the weakness you have being on the bottom of the chain. And the advice given from, you know, semi-state funding and grant groups and, you know, very well recognized business mentors and people who I respected was, you know, get your brand going, make it strong, get onto the shelves of whatever supermarket and, you know, do this kind of thing. And this was 8 or 9 years ago when that really was the message that was being sent. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't feel right to me at the time. And I'm so glad that I felt that then, because I look now at my peers of that time who were building great brands and great products and authentic and genuine and hardworking, who were just destroyed in that system. You know, you take all the loans, you take all the risk, you do all the hours. If it's a failure, we flick you out. And if it's a success, we just own brand it and make our one look like your one, mm-hmm. and then flick you out. You know,
I'm glad you actually talked on that, because I've spoke to a number of different people who've been in that exact situation, but they're still involved in the businesses, so they haven't been able to express it quite as clearly as you have. It seems like an incredibly, incredibly tough business to try get into.
I think breaking through with the public is easier than people think, and therefore a lot of people fall victim to it. Mm. You know, and I think the message out there is start your own thing, get your self set up, go through these, you know, and then there'll be this green pasture on the other side of it. But it's the producer at the end of the day is taking the weight of decisions made up top, you know. And at the end of the day, what's left, it's so hard to consider quality when all that pressure is being put down on something.
Yeah, true.
And that was very much part of the spirit of Neighborfood as well, which is that let's build this model where we can be quite clear in the beginning about our philosophies. We will not control your price. We won't say anything to you about your price. If you want to overcharge for that product, then the public will decide and they won't buy it. But that's your decision as the producer. Yeah. We're never going to put you on offer. We're never going to tell you there's a discount this week, so you got to drop your prices. We're also never going to tell you, if you can't give us 4,000 of those next week, we have to get a different person supplying. So you know, the customer is always first, and we always do consider the customer first, but it's built with producers in mind to try and say to these small producers, you can have a business that you can grow to a level that you feel comfortable with, and we're going to try and get you more money for the effort you're putting in.
I love the model. Explain the bit to me about the hosts, because this, I was reading through the website. I was like, oh, this is genius. You have hosts in each town or village. So explain how that works. So I think that is just one of your most unique points.
A host is someone in a community who has access or creates access to a physical collection point, and they manage the handover to the customers. And they also manage the contact with the producers to make sure that everything goes smoothly, physically. Mm. And they work with us, and they work for a percentage commission, as do we. So they are basically, they're our agent, but they work for themselves independently using our software. And then we try and assist them in anything they might need help with and sharing experiences, I suppose.
I love it, because it strikes everything that I'm kind of about, is about kind of empowering people to become entrepreneurs, and empowering people just with a little bit of support and a framework to go, look, this is your territory. You decide, you know, you make it a success. So you're kind of empowering the producers on one hand, and then an aspiring set of entrepreneurs as well.
Yeah, what's really, really incredible is how every single one shows me something I missed about the idea that I obsess over.
Yeah.
And I'm really not exaggerating when I say that. There are people who are incredible in one thing, but maybe lack an understanding in another. Or you've got some people whose personalities are so well fitted to one thing, but maybe they struggle with another. And everybody is different. And we try and see where the gaps are and try and help people with the things they might need help with. But it's never to be underestimated how each time we bring on a new host, they're going to bring forward something to me. And I'm like, oh yeah, of course, that's how we should do this. You know,
I love that
which is really cool.
It's incredible.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Well, I think to build a brilliant business like this, you have to be blinkered. You have to be so single-minded in the success of, we are making this a success, so that to be able to bring in outside people with fresh ideas, it's a beautiful mix. It's that injection of fresh blood. It's superb.
Yeah. And we hope that we can instill in them an ownership of it. And it's very much the case that each individual neighborhood location is much more the host than it is us. You know, we'll identify that host and we'll pick the best hosts we can, and we'll bring the best producers on that we can, and we'll do everything we can for the umbrella brand. But at the end of the day, it is these amazing people in communities who rally the troops and gather the customers and show people how to order food online, because that's the hardest online change to a community. You can buy anything online, but are you going to do your shopping for your food online? You know, it's like the one thing that was kind of holding people back a little bit, I think.
But, I think COVID has just, I was just going to say, you took the words in my mouth there. COVID has changed people's mentalities, especially about, you know, food ordering and just basics and everyday essentials ordering. I think people would always still go to the Dunn's, the Aldi's, the Tesco's, you know, their local shops. But now I think that has, because it mandatorily had to. So it's rocketed you forward. So what's happened? Kind of talk to me on what's happened for Neighbor Food in the last kind of, let's say, since March.
For us, for me personally, and for my business partner, Martin, it was like a hobby that had a couple of hundred euros a month to give us. It was kind of like a thing we were proud of and that we enjoyed doing and had loads of positive moments, but like it had never reached a point of genuine profitability. And we certainly didn't have any budget to be able to grow any faster than we were, but we were growing. It was organic. It was nice. We were still getting good attention from PR, and we were still having new markets emerging. But in March, it just completely flipped to a point that suddenly it made sense to people. It made sense to the producers. It made sense to the customers. And people were happy to use it and happy to try it. And producers were happy to dive in and give it a go as well. And there was just this huge growth that we were able to, you know, to have.
And how has that grown in terms of how many new markets have launched, and how much has it grown in that time?
Well, I actually established this morning on a phone call with a new host in Haddington, which is a small village outside Edinburgh in Scotland, we established a new market, and I realized it was actually the 100th market that I've created on the database.
Brilliant. Congrats. That's a big, big landmark.
But, but they haven't all opened, you see, because many of them are in construction. Okay. And some of them might be paused, and some of them might be transitioning in different ways. But but it was the actual 100th one that I've, you know, pressed enter on in setting up. So we currently, I think, have about 63 markets that are active. Mm-hmm. We probably have about 15 that are coming online for certain. And then we probably have another 10 that are like, you know, maybe have been paused for some reason, or maybe are transitioning that were open and are now closed because they need to find a new location. So COVID does make it a little bit tricky with things, because just to give you one example, the GAA are under a lot of pressure at the moment to cease any type of operations in their halls. We actually operate in GAA halls.
Oh, of course. It makes a lot of sense too,
Yeah. So we're completely contact-free, completely safe, but obviously these big organizations need to do everything they can to reduce the spread of COVID. So it's just unfortunate sometimes, like any church-related parish kind of, you know, church-managed community centers would also be under the same kind of pressure, or schools as well, you know. So some of our locations are a little bit flexible at the moment.
Okay. And how is it growing in terms of, is it word of mouth? I think you touched on it there. It's word of mouth mainly. It's kind of customers and hosts talking about it.
Yeah, but there's a huge part of like the food community talking a lot about it. So that would have been our initial kind of growth. But you can't underestimate and say just because you've got loads of people liking and sharing your things on social media, and because you've got the Irish Times or different medias, you know, wanting to do pieces with you, the reality is you're still only scraping the surface of the amount of people who might be interested in what you're doing. So for the last couple of months, we've been building a huge kind of campaign within Facebook and Instagram and with Google to try and do targeted advertising, to try and do our best to put this in front of anyone who might be interested, who might not have tried it out yet. So that's been really successful, and that's working really, really well.
Excellent.
And then we're also trying to look at, you know, what more do our customers want from what we can provide? And even more so, what more do our producers need to be able to make more money through the site? And we're definitely exploring small and bigger, much, much bigger ways in which we can grow that. So you kind of half your time really with trying to drive as much people and innovation into tomorrow, while also trying to give 50% of your time to trying to put it into, you know, 12 months time or 6 months time or 3 months time.
Yeah, it does feel like one of those ideas though, that we'll be looking back in, well, hopefully we will, in a year or two's time, and just kind of going at COVID as being your inflection point of like, suddenly that was the time when all your preparation and everything that you'd done in the background suddenly became a reality, and just external forces just propelled it to the front.
Well, it's funny you say that, because, you know, the work done in the background, like whatever about me, because when you have an idea, it's very easy to get behind it and just kind of rally forward. But my business partner, Martin, who's an incredible software developer, I won him over on the idea and we started. And in many ways, there was moments where we had these flash of successes where I was vindicated in the idea and he was completely vindicated in his software, because it just got pressure tested, you know, like we had 70 people using it in Cork for Christmas the first year, having been open for 3 weeks. You know, you've got 70 different families doing their full Christmas shopping through the software, which is like, that's really big. Like it's complicated, and it's there's so many, there's 100,000 lines of code minimum, because we started with that. So God, I don't know where we are now. So it's really complicated. You've money going here and there because there's splitting and there's refunds and there's, and when you're like watching it for the first time going, oh my God, like this whole thing's going to crash. And then you hear of stories of websites crashing, of systems going down, of all of these types of things. And Martin is incredible, my business partner, developer, because he built something that survived. But I think he'd be the first one to agree with me in that that year and a half before COVID, when we just tickled away, trickled down, added new things, built delivery, built multiple collection points, you know, built graphing systems within the portal so that the hosts could see what's trending and what's not in their selections. Like all of these little things that we just plugged away with and worked on. There is no way we would have been able to handle what happened in March without that year and a half of going along.
I think so. I'm really grateful. That's a huge point though, Jack.
Like if we had launched in January, and COVID happened in March, I genuinely would be a very, very sick person right now, because I drove myself to losing something like 7 or 8 kilos from March to June.
Wow.
Because I just didn't, I either, you know, fed a baby, beautiful, emotional, welcoming into the family, or I sat at a computer. And I mean, until 3 or 4 a.m. and up again at night. And I did that 7 days a week until the middle of the summer, when I eventually was able to kind of try and regulate my time a bit more. But if we didn't have the actual system working as well as it did at that point, I can't imagine, it would have been a disaster.
You've revealed something very important there, and thanks for sharing it, because I think a lot of people have that tendency after the first 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, oh, I haven't met it yet. And you see a huge fall off in people in terms of, they just give up the idea, or they kind of have to the idea, but don't fully do it. And they get disheartened and they kind of give up. But like, that's a perfect example of you just need to keep going step by step by step. And eventually, if you've put in the hard work at the right places, at the right time, it'll slowly start to take off, in your case, quickly.
I think that that's definitely true. And the other thing that I think about a lot, because, you know, it's not my, I've had two official limited company businesses, but I've also done a lot of consultancy, and I've worked on projects from conception to completion. So I kind of know what it's like to take an idea and make it a real thing. I've been honored and proud to have been part of other people's ones, and I've had my own ones. And it's like the testing times when you want something to work and it doesn't work, it's really hard. Mm. Like, it's really hard to swallow the fact that it didn't work, but it's also really hard to swallow the fact that you might be the one capable of making it work, because you feel like you're just void of ideas. Like, if that was what I thought would work and that didn't, how do I fix this? And that can be quite a desperate moment to be in. And, you know, it's not about like dusting yourself off and picking yourself back up, but it's a little bit more about finding answers to problems is much more successful way to find it than finding them from nothing. Does that make sense? So
yeah,
like,
yeah,
the issues that you come across within the things you're trying to do, like, I know everyone says like you're measured by your failures and not by your successes. And what I think what that generally kind of means is that the actual real solid good stuff that comes out of it really does come from the failure more than from the successes.
Yeah.
Because the idea that I had day one, all the producers stood around inside and you walked up to a farmer and he handed over the carrots to you.
Yeah.
Like, that alone seemed like a beautiful thing, but on so many different fundamental levels, that was a disaster. Certainly in COVID, but even before COVID it was, you know.
Yeah.
So there's been...
I'm sure the producers didn't want to be doing it either. I'm sure they didn't want to be standing there every single day. I used to live in Grand Canal, and there used to be a market that used to sit up there every Thursday. And I would be looking at them. I'd be leaving like maybe at like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and they'd be there. Yeah. They'd be in the dark, head torches on, relaying out all their fucking stands, and then building up the boilers and the, oh my God, my heart went out to them every single week. Like,
stuff. When I hear of, like, you know, people who have fixed rates, rated premises, and they give out about the rent and the rates and everything. And like, I try to say to them, that person who has that stall might not be paying as much in those things as you are. They're paying a small amount, but like, they have to build their shop every day, and that's fine. Because some people are morning people, have coffee, put it together, great crack. But they have to take it down at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And then they have to take it home, and then they have to wash everything and then repack it into the van. It is tough. It's really tough. But it is very, very, very pleasurable. And it's not going to go anywhere. Like, farmers markets and market trading is so important for the public as a means of socializing, as a connection with internal economies within smaller communities. But for the traders who trade at them, it is a family.
Mm.
And there's all types of strife and all types of conflicts with interpersonal relationships and all that, as you can imagine. But there is a sense of community like no other within those markets.
Shared hardship really, bonds you to people very quickly.
Shared hardship. Yeah, but, you know, and assistance. Like, everyone needs assistance when you're a trader at a market. Some gust of wind comes, blows half your thing over. What, you know, it happens to everybody. So there's a real sense of community. It's good.
How did you get Martin involved in the project? Because he seems to have been a key addition.
Yeah, I mean, I considered when I first thought of the idea, I was like, okay, I'll just find a developer and I'll just pay for this to be built. So I started looking at companies that build software, and I kind of very soon realized that I was being a complete idiot because I wanted to build a software company without a software developer sitting at the top. Like, that's just, and then so many people do that. Like, so many different startups are someone with a great idea who subcontracts out what the actual essence of the company is. And I'm really, really glad I thought of that and discovered that early. Maybe someone said it to me, or maybe it just dawned on me, but I can't remember now. So I kind of thought, right, I'm going to find someone, I'm going to win them over, and I'm going to give them, you know, an equal share to me, because I don't need to be the only one who's really sitting at the top of this. I wanted a partner. So yeah, Martin was recommended to me by someone in the food industry, because he has another company called TablePath, which is a restaurant table reservation software.
Okay. How did you swing him on the idea?
I don't know if I needed to swing him very much on the idea. I think he got into the idea really quickly. I think the luck, from my point of view, was that he had just reached a point with TablePath where he felt that he really liked it as a product, and that he had a good few customers, but that he should consider something. Like, I think Martin really loves developing. Like, I think he really likes creating things and making products.
Okay.
And I think that he got excited and inspired to create something new. So it was pretty easy to win him over.
That's one
pint, if I remember correctly.
he was a cheap date. It usually takes a lot more than that. You always hear that's the hard point. I was literally had someone else on yesterday, and they were saying it was, you know, they made the exact same point as you, and it's something that keeps coming up. Is trying to build a technology company without developers just madness? It's like building a restaurant with no chef. You know, it's like having a restaurant and just buying in all your food already cooked and just hoping that everything stays the same. So I think that's great advice for any budding software developers out there, or software entrepreneurs, is to find someone who is going to help you build that, because otherwise you're really at a huge disadvantage.
Yeah, and not every position that's required in a software company is a developer either. You know, so like my position and Martin's position, the different roles that we fill and the different stuff that we need to do, I'm sure he's super thankful that I am the other person that he's with looking after the other sides of things. But you got to have at least one, maybe even two, you know?
Yeah.
Like, our first big hire will hopefully be a C# senior developer in the next couple of weeks. We have a junior developer working with us at the moment, and he's been fantastic, but it's just, there's no break for Martin. If anything goes wrong, and which it does all the time, I mean, we integrate with so many different international systems that constantly go down, that constantly change their format. Visa decides that they're going to do something to 3D Secure, and all of a sudden we have people who can't pay for their products. It happens all the time. It's nothing to do with us. It's the world around us. And the poor fella has to be diving onto a laptop within 30 seconds to fix the problem. You know, so we need to get in another serious developer soon.
I think that's good advice, and it's a good story to hear for people as well, because I think a lot of people take the opportunity and go, oh, do you know what? I'll just get it built, and then sure, it'll just run itself. They forget about all the other stuff that has to come with it every single day.
It's actually in the name. That's hardware. Yeah.
So what is the plan for Neighborfood? Take me up to where we're going with this. What's the plan for the next kind of, say, 3 to 6 to 12 months?
Well, I think at the moment, I'd love to get this new developer on so that we can move a little bit quicker through a lot of the kind of smaller changes we want to make to optimize the experience for all of our users, producers and sellers and hosts. And that deserves a lot of time. So I think we're going to take that really seriously the next couple of weeks. We're interviewing people already. From there, then I think myself and Martin are going to work on some of the bigger picture type of things, which I won't talk about now just because they'll change. It's not like they're a secret, but they will no doubt change, and I'll end up kicking myself for saying something. But just other ways that Neighborfood can bring customers and producers together, and other ways we can generate revenue for people who use our software to sell. So that's what we're going to be focusing on. And then, of course, in the background, we just continue trying to grow in Ireland and the UK. and we continue trying to establish new communities, to bring on new producers, and to continue to just build the customer base that we have. I mean, the amazing thing is that it's quite consistent. And at the beginning of the week, when I see the sales closing for certain markets, because obviously if the market collection is on a Tuesday, it closes earlier in the week, closes on a Sunday. So I can start to see the trend then, and I know exactly where other markets are going to go as the week goes on. So we just need to build up that base, basically, and just bring that higher in most places. But I think we're doing it. You know, you can see it piecing together every week a little bit more. So
beautiful. You got one new sign up in me last Friday when Isabel pitched it to me. So I'm already waiting for the Wicklow market to come on board. If people are listening, Jack, and they think, I'd love to get involved either as a producer or a host, how can they do that?
Well, I like host applications and producer applications are done through neighborfood.ie. Become a host and become a producer. But in fact, we can't physically get through the list of pending producers. So we work with the host. So once we establish a host in a location, that host will then put themselves live on the page so producers can request to join that particular market. And then the host will put together their list of who's going to join them, and then we verify those producers. So if there was a producer out there that really felt that they wanted to be part of it and that there was a market near them, they should go through the host rather than coming directly to us.
Okay.
Because we can verify you as a producer on Neighborfood, but if you don't have somewhere to sell, then there's really no point. So each of the different markets, the host actually curates the selection of those markets. So we don't put producers into different places.
Okay, perfect. So there's people listening who are aspiring hosts, get in touch with you guys and as producers, search for your local market, see if there's one there. And if not, then maybe
get in touch with your local host. Yeah.
Brilliant. And where can people actually go and learn more about like Neighborfood and also about yourself, Jack?
For me, I don't think there's anywhere you can learn about me, but
modest.
If you'd like to learn more about Neighborfood, we have a lot of content we're creating at the moment. We want to try and, if there's any legacy, if we're not going to be around in 2 years' time, or maybe we are, but either way, we want to make sure that we gave back to the food community while we were here. So we're investing a good bit of time and money into producer interviews, host interviews, points of interesting information around the country to do with food, and trying to build that in a YouTube channel. So that's kind of coming on now. There's quite a bit there. I think it's about 30 videos at this stage. So Neighborfood on YouTube.
Brilliant. That sounds great. And then it's neighborfood.ie.
Neighborfood.ie.
Brilliant. Yeah. Listen, Jack, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gary. I really appreciate it.
And that was episode 100. It feels good to say that every single time. I hope you enjoyed the episode with Jack. Do try out Neighborfood. In fact, Neighborfood has just launched here in Wicklow beside me, so I'm going to try it this Thursday. I cannot wait. I'll see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab. Have a great week.